on the telephone with us, someone who's become intimately familiar with grand hotels both in New York and probably in other places across the world, but most recently in London. He's written a book called London's Grand Hotels, Extraordinary People, Extraordinary Service in the World's Cultural Capital. His name is Ward Morehouse III, and I was going to give his whole bio again, but I think we'll just get to it. Ward, first of all, where are you calling from right now?
I'm calling from South Carolina, from Shiloh, South Carolina. I'm on my way to Savannah, Georgia, and I'm going to do a book signing in Chavers Bookstore and also be interviewed by the Savannah Morning News. I wrote for that, briefly for about a year. I did a column from New York called Manhattan Musings, and Savannah had its own grand hotel back in the dark ages. It had the DeSoto Hotel, which was torn down in the 1960s or late 1950s, and it was a grand Victorian palace, and people like George M. Cohan and Sarah Bernhardt and many of the stars of yesteryear stayed at the old DeSoto Hotel. There's a DeSoto Hilton in its place, but it's nothing like the grand architecture of the old homestead, so to speak. The Georgian Terrace is still alive and well in Georgia. You know, that was one of the host hotels for the premiere of Gone with the Wind in Atlanta in 1939.
Oh, yeah.
Huh. So you're mm-hmm. playing a grand hotel is very apt, Dave, because I was just as you mentioned, I was in London and I stayed at the Haymarket Hotel, which is not grand in the sense of the Ritz or the Savoy or say the Connaught or the some of the bigger establishments in London, but it is next to the Haymarket Theatre. And one of the themes in my book is that theatre and stars and movies and hotels are very intimately connected. And John Barrymore, when he was in Hamlet in London, he was in Hamlet at the Haymarket Theatre, which is next to what is now the Haymarket Hotel, run by Ferndale Hotels. And it was just interesting. I think the last time I stayed at the Haymarket Hotel when I was researching the book was about a year and a half ago, and On the Waterfront was playing. It was a different version than the one that was on Broadway. It was actually very good.
Yeah.
But the Haymarket, Barrymore, who was in Grand Hotel, the movie, not the Broadway version you played, mm-hmm. actually had to act as an actor manager taking his show over to London because, people think he was such a huge success in New York in 1922 in Hamlet. Well, yes, that's true. He played 100 performances and got rave reviews, but he still had to go sort of hat in hand in London and actually had to work about 6 months in order to get a venue that would take him. And then he had to actually fund part of the run himself. And then, of course, he made a lot of money when it opened and got good reviews. But it wasn't easy. It wasn't just like snapping your fingers kind of thing. But the Grand Hotels is like being in a grand opera, whether it's the Waldorf Astoria in New York or the Plaza or, the Brown Palace in Denver. And there's something about it that has a theatrical atmosphere that I don't think other things do.
Now, Ward, your appreciation for luxury and sort of old and grand hotels began really at the knees of your dad, who was...
Yes.
Well, why don't you explain, tell everybody who your dad was.
He was a drama critic. He started, in Savannah, Georgia, where I'm headed for now, and used to have something called the Minor Stock Company. He used to put on his own plays, and then he became a reporter, and then he went to Atlanta, Georgia, where he was a reporter for 3 years, then he came to New York in 1919, and worked on the old Herald Tribune and then the New York Sun in 1926, where he had a column called Broadway After Dark. And then he actually had a couple of plays on Broadway. One was called Gentlemen of the Press in 1928. It opened the same month, almost the same week, as The Front Page. And it was actually made into a movie with Walter Huston. This is Gentlemen of the Press.
Yeah.
But The Front Page went on to great fame and glory, and Gentlemen of the Press sort of faded out with the old... the vintage movies of the early the late 1920s. So he loved hotels, and he lived in 29 hotels in New York When I was growing up, I lived in a hotel called the Hotel Seymour, which was next to, when my parents were together, we lived together in an apartment house. My parents lived in the Plaza and the Waldorf before I was born. And then after my parents were divorced, my father and stepmother went to live in the Plaza, and they lived there for 11 years. So I would visit on weekends mostly. And you know, have a great time running around the halls like a male Eloise, sort of. And that's how I got.
Or like the kid in The Shining, but yeah. But yeah. One thing I'm curious about, like in that era, let's say your father, I mean, obviously he must have made a good living, so he was able to live in the Plaza Hotel for 11 years. My question is, like, compared to what would he have been that cost him? As opposed to living in an apartment or a house?
My calculation is that it's about $300 a month, which was pretty high for an apartment in those days. I don't know what the equivalent, this would be in the 60s. I don't know what the equivalent today would be. But this is a monthly rent. At one time, the Plaza and a number of the hotels in New York had what they call permanents. And about 50% of the hotels were filled with permanent residents. You know, Cole Porter was a permanent resident of the Waldorf in Suite 33A for about 30 years, from 1931 or 32 until practically he died. And then Frank Sinatra took over with the help of Capitol Records, took over that suite and paid about $1 million a year. So the price, you know, was considerably up. And you know, then you're talking about a 3 or 4 bedroom huge apartment. And my father had a one-bedroom apartment at the Plaza. It looked big to me as a kid with a kitchen, but it wasn't, by comparison to those grander places, it wasn't grand. It was a nice, say, one-bedroom apartment in New York City. One of the things he had that I'll never forget was a bear that he got from Bangkok, and the bear used to run around the kitchen.
A bear? A bear? Bear.
Yeah, a little brown bear would run around. It was the era, David, when you could bring in wild animals legally. You didn't have to put them under your coat or something. You could bring them in legally with the proper papers. And he came into, I think, San Francisco, stayed at the Mark in San Francisco. The bear promptly tore up the bathroom there.
Yeah.
And then he came to New York, and it tore up the kitchen and the bathroom, and then he had to move. And then, I mean, not my father, but the bear. It was, you know, they're obstreperous. You know, they get bigger and they're wild things.
Yeah.
And so they are uncontrollable. But
as a
small cub, they're pretty gentle. Gentle like a puppy dog, I would say.
So you got to pet the bear and play with the bear while he was a little...
Yeah, got to pet the bear and play with the bear. On weekends, I wasn't there when the bear terrorized the maid, you know.
How would you like to be a maid in a hotel room and walk in and there's a bear roaming around? Good
I
job.
Know, you got to remember, it's only like a foot long or a foot and a half long at that time. So they're small, they're cuddly and cute. But, you know, give them a couple months and they have sharp claws. And the bear was then sent to a farm in Georgia, and then eventually to Ringling Brothers Circus. He collected wild animals. I had a lion cub growing up in another hotel, the Hotel Seymour. And it was just a menagerie. That's why, you know... That's why I became a drama reporter. Because of the crazy life, you know.
So how did you, I mean, this is an interesting thought. I mean, how were you able to follow in your father's footsteps? Did he open any doors for you?
I can't say that I really honor him. I can't say that I've really followed in the way that he did. I think there was a different Broadway, although I'm beginning to appreciate it as I've never done before, because I'm not... I do a website called BroadwayAfterDark.com. I have a number of writers who work for the website. We have a respectable number of visitors. Mm-hmm. He really had the great claim to see all the wonderful plays of the first part of this century. And I think that as a New York Sun, for, this is from Eugene O'Neill to Tennessee Williams to, you know, many, many plays over the years from the 1920s really to the 1960s. And I think that I sort of missed that, and I think that he also was a, even though he had Wild Animals, was a very gentle columnist. And I used to go to the theater with him and take notes, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he would take his notes, and my notes didn't make any sense, but his scribblings went into a column of some sort. He went to work for North American Newspaper Alliance as a feature reporter, and the Newhouse papers after the New York Sun died. I worked for the Sun briefly, the new New York Sun.
Oh,
unfortunately,
yeah.
it also died. And
yeah.
And you know, just the cost of papers, the journalism today, you know, these websites and radio shows like you do are getting much more respect because you know, they're the heir apparent for the newspaper business. I don't know what exactly is going to happen to it eventually. You know, the New York Times has more readers online than it does, you know, buying the paper.
Well, because, you know, in the old days, it occurred to me, because it's funny, I thought about this literally this week, because I looked at a newspaper,
right.
I think it was the Times, and it was 75 cents or maybe a dollar, and I'm like, hey, you know, in the old days, you drop a quarter, and you get a paper. Now you have to pay, like, a buck for a newspaper, and not just a Sunday. Sunday's like $3 or $4. And it's
exactly.
Like, no wonder people aren't buying it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a shame. But I do understand the sea change, you know?
It is a shame. But, you know, also, remember, I don't know, it's hard to get in some cases, and you can get it online. You can Google NewYorkTimes.com or any other paper you want, the Christian Science Monitor or the, you know, the Miami Herald, and you can get a pretty good version without the ads right on your cell phone or your BlackBerry or your whatever, or your computer. I think it's a... it's an interesting era, and I think in books too. I don't think London's Grand Hotel's not an e-book, but I've got a book on the a redo of the book on the Plaza coming out early next year. I did one in about 10 years ago called Inside the Plaza: History of the Plaza Hotel, and I think it may come out as an e-book first. The new version. I put about 3 new chapters together, but you know, it's a. Things have changed where your newspaper's on your telephone. I mean, in my book, London's Grand Hotels, I talk about in the chapter on Brown's Hotel, which goes back to the 1800s. The first phone call was made by Alexander Graham Bell in Brown's Hotel, and I interviewed Ira Gassman. Do you know Ira, David?
Vaguely rings a bell. I don't know him. Yeah.
Yeah. He wrote the lyrics for The Life.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And which. Had a respectable run, but, you know, not a great run. And it was then he was did something for Woody Allen. He was did the music for The Front, or did the lyrics for the music for The Front. And he and Woody Allen were sitting in the in Brown's Hotel, and Ira Gassman was complaining. I know Ira because he actually, speaking of hotels, he lives in the Gramercy Park Hotel in New York. He's one of the only permanent residents, and I think he. I don't know what he pays. They've been trying to buy him out, but he doesn't want to be bought out. But he pays, you know, comparatively nothing compared to what you would pay for a, you know, a single room per night as a hotel guest. But he was talking to Woody Allen, and Ira was complaining in Brown's Hotel in London that Zero Mostel, who was in The Front, which was being filmed partly in London, he said, you know, this guy is destroying my lyrics. Every time he opens his mouth, it's a different lyric. I can't sleep. I can't eat. You know, I work like a dog on these lyrics. And Woody turns to him and says, "You know, Ira, you want my advice? Take the money and run." he said, "Be quiet." You know.
And I recall, they didn't really leave any music in The Front. I don't recall Mostel doing any songs in
that. No, it was background music and. And there were some lyrics in the background, and I don't know really what it was, and I don't recall myself. But he told me that he worked on it, and it wasn't Zero Mostel. He was a very capable singer, as you know, in many shows. But
Zero does.
The funny thing happened the way the
be.
Forum and everything. But no, I don't think he had any actual songs in it.
Well,
but
do you see yourself more? Ward, do you see yourself as now morphing more into a travel writer? Except, although you're the editor of Broadway After Dark, so you're still straddling both. What is Broadway After Dark, by the way?
Broadway After Dark is a website. It started out like as a personal website, but then I've got about 20 people working for it, including Sandy Durrell and many other writers. Beatrice Rood, who was married to Bob Williams on the New York Post, Sandy Durrell, many contributing, about 20 contributing writers, like a lot of these websites. It's not as extensive by any means as something like Playbill, which has always the latest news. I try to keep up with the latest news, and occasionally I'll break a story, like I broke the story on Patricia Neal dying, because I had an inside track to that. But ironically, I called the New York Post and, with a story, and they hardly knew who she was. They're interested in current people, and, she was a great star, as in many movies, and on Broadway, she won the first Tony Award, I think it was given out by the Tony Committee. But it's really sort of like a mini Playbill Online or Theater Mania. I worked for Theater Mania when Joe Corcoran had it and did some reviews. Mm-hmm. And I don't know which direction it's going to go, very frankly, Dave. I've tried to put some travel stuff on it, but you're right. I have segued a little bit into the travel area. I did a book on the Waldorf, did a book on London hotels and on the Plaza.
Well, I'm just trying to give the listeners a sense of what is on Broadway After Dark. Is it columns?
Yes, it's columns and reviews of plays on Broadway and off Broadway. We have a review of Lebette, for instance. We have a review of Pittman Painters and Bloody Andrew Jackson. So there are reviews. They're not as extensive. I've also tried to make a point. We have a few younger reviewers, Julia Giansetti, who's an actress herself, who's, I guess, in her 20s or so, and she covers some of the off-off Broadway. It's always been my feeling that even the websites don't cover the off-off Broadway like, I hesitate to use the word they should, because it's up to them. But, they get short shrift by the bigger papers, and I don't think the Daily News covers much of anything anymore, and the Post does more. But
I have to ask this. Do you have any hard feelings about the Post? Because I was working at Playbill. Playbill during
the
time when
I don't. My editor was left, and then a new editor came in. And I was fired, and I think it was a good thing that I was let go. I mean, usually when a new editor comes in, you go right away. But I had an editor I worked for 5 years. I did the Broadway column for the New York Post, and got a few scoops like The Lion King coming to Broadway and Whoopi Goldberg going into Funny Thing Happened the Way of the Forum. I sort of haunted the Broadway area, but I also went overboard. I think I tended to play to be sort of a minor Walter Winchell, and I think it was a fortuitous thing that I was actually let go when the new editor came in. And he came in, and the guy who was on, Mike Riedel, who I was friendly with, but he was on the New York Sun, New York Daily News, he took my place.
Right.
I don't regret it for a second. Obviously it's not fun to be fired or to be let go or whatever you want to call it.
But it was the right move at the right time.
But it was a good move for me, because I went more into the travel area. I also have gotten friendly with and reclaimed some of the sources that I had originally when I was with the Christian Science Monitor, and I make it a point for Broadway After Dark to do nothing. I don't do gossip, and I don't do mean-spirited stories. And I got to the point on the Post, I think, where I was mean-spirited in some cases. I would, cover the gossip, and sometimes, it may have been untrue. And I would listen to someone who said, oh, yeah, there's a big fight backstage and that kind of thing. And, it was not good. It wasn't healthy for me, because I didn't grow up in that kind of atmosphere. My father was not a gossip writer. He was a reviewer and a columnist who covered the news. And actually, so I've patched up a lot of hurt feelings that I think that that people had, and I tried to not make amends, so to speak. But very often I did get some scoops. You know, the unfortunate thing about people like Walter Winchell is that he was very good to a lot of people. You know, one word from him, and I remember when I was in the Post, I did some positive things too. But of course, when you're when you're out of the job, they say, "Oh, he was no good," or you know, he got things wrong, or he was too mean, or whatever you want to say. And there's some truth in that too. But I think that now I've sort of gone home again, in the sense that I've kind of gone back to the kind of theater coverage and feeling about the theater that my father had, you know, which is a very warm sort of friendly feeling. But it's not fun to lose a job that pays very well.
Sure, of course. It must have been a difficult time, but looking back on it, it was because you would not have been happy under that new regime, which, you know.
I wouldn't have been happy, and also I wouldn't have been happy continuing to do what I did, being a gossip reporter, really, for, you know, the backstage stuff. And I'm not criticizing what Mike Riedel does or what other people do, some other people. There are not that many of them that do the kind of stuff he does. It wasn't me, really. I mean, it was because I did it for a couple of years, but it was not pleasant in some ways. And let me ask you,
let's move back to the travel aspect, because you have just written this new book, London's Grand Hotels, which is published, by the way, by Bayer. Oh, I can't read the thing on the spine. What is it?
Bayer Manor Media.
Bayer,
and, you know, they do a lot of nostalgia books. They've done some books on Roy Rogers, on, Andy Devine, and many, King Vidor.
Oh,
I think that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah,
King Vidor, silent movie director, or movie director. And people like that, you know, names you've heard of, but maybe not the biggest stars of the day. I mean, somebody else may have done Rio Valentino or John Barrymore, but they've done the... Tom Bix and some of the other. So they have a good internet presence too.
Good for them. I mean, I've never heard of them, but they put out a nice book. Well, is this also in hardcover? I know you sent me a trade paperback.
It's going into hardcover in the spring.
Okay.
That is really the best time for travel books. They say is the spring, so it's going to be made into a hardcover in the spring, and then. I think we've gotten some nice little write-ups. Cindy Adams did a little write-up of it, some travel magazines have done some things. I think we'll get a review or two with one of the bigger papers. But it's it'll be a hardcover in the spring. You never know. It used to be that the hardcover would come out first, and then it would go into paperback. But I don't. They're expensive to produce, and so the publisher, they claim they run on a slim margin. I'm not so sure sometimes.
This day and age they probably do, but yeah. But the nice thing is, this day and age they can publish a book and do a run of 500 copies, not 12,000, and then they can reprints.
That's exactly right, David. Yeah. And, also, throughout the whole industry, it's become more of a print-on-demand. You have, if Steven Spielberg writes a book, or, Tom Hanks or somebody like that, they'll print, 5 million copies.
Right.
And, but for most authors today, many of the books are print-on-demand. With a digital technology, you can print up copies in a matter of a week. And so they don't have the shelf space. They don't want to take the risk of printing copies that are just going to sit there. You know, 40, this is not a self-produced book. It's a small publishing company. But 40 authors, I was told, and again, this may be in the realm of gossip, left Knopf to go on their own and publish their own works. And these were recognized authors, maybe not big stars, but Knopf is one of the big imprints.
Right.
And because they realized that they weren't getting the publicity, they weren't getting the back office help that they needed to promote books, and with the internet, they could do better on their own, and making their own deals. So, you know, it's a brave new world in a way, or maybe I don't know what it is, but it's a different new world. And I think that a lot of it is dependent on the on what the author is willing to invest in promoting the book. You know,
yeah.
You've done a couple books yourself.
Well, I've written the introductions for that Best Play series a few years back.
Right.
And also I had a book published in, of all places, Russia, where a bunch of academics wanted to publish my plays, which I was like, okay, thank you. And they did. So, thank you very much.
Yeah, right.
But not in America. Yeah. But it was...
And the smaller bookstores are also... every big town has, like... Savannah has Shaver's bookstore. There's a big bookstore in Denver. I forget the name of it. That's huge. It's an independent bookstore. But places like the Applause Theater and Cinema Books that published.
Well, that's gone, man.
I think they still
publish, but their store is gone.
Right. And you're familiar with the Drama Bookstore on 40th Street, which is across from the new New York Times building. They were telling me that they're having a tough time. I don't think they're going to close because they're very much a specialty shop.
Yeah.
Now, my book is available in London at the at some place called the Dress Circle, which is in Covent Garden, and they do both CDs and books on the theater. And you know, I had to explain to them that the book also includes many theatrical anecdotes with Vivian Leigh and Laurence Olivier and people like that going way back. You know, to the turn of the last century, like Barrymore, or he wasn't the turn of the last century, but he was in the 1920s in London. But it's it's also something called Stanford's Travel Store, which is a huge travel store. We don't have anything quite like it in the big cities in New York. I don't think we used to have the Hammond Map Store, you know. And everything's going online, and so you don't need the physical presence of some of these stores. The Barnes & Noble is closing at 66th and Broadway, or 67th and Broadway.
Wow. Did the Strand close, or is that still there?
That's still there, I believe. Yeah. And that, I think that's a mainstay, and, you know, goes on for miles of books or blocks of books, anyway. And the Barnes & Noble, of course, has a number of stores in New York that are not closing. The one, 20th Street or 19th Street and 5th Avenue and the one at 86th Street, and so they're around. It's just that big one that was near Lincoln Center, and sort of some of the theatrical people went to
has
announced it was closing.
It's kind of like the publishing industry. Really, this coming decade is going to be hit with the same thing that the music industry was hit in the late 90s and the 10s. The whole thing sea changed. It's just like you have to find a new paradigm. You have to find a new business model, because either that or you're just going to sink.
It used to be you get a contract for a record, you know, it was a pretty good deal. And now they're very few and far between to get those contracts. Remember Laura Bell Bundy, who was in Legally Blonde? I think she went to, maybe she's done pretty well, but the whole idea, she went to Nashville to try to get a contract, and I think it was difficult, and maybe she succeeded. You know, she's a good singer, but I haven't heard too much about her. Doesn't mean that she's not doing very well outside of New York.
No, but most of I follow more rock and pop rather than country, but, I mean, so many of the great rock and pop artists went independent in the last decade. They finished their contracts with their major labels, and they said, maybe not the big acts, but the smaller and intermediate acts, people you've heard of, just said, okay, you know, I might as well, I'm going to make more money just touring in my little bus with the little band and selling the CDs, you know, at the end of the show than I will trying to deal with a big place that won't even pay me.
Right. And that's where the money is these days, but it takes even people like, the huge superstars like Keith Richards and the Rolling Stones, they tour, you know, every day practically, and they're the, you know, the top money earners, or one of the top money earners. But, you know, these bands that you and I may never have heard of, or only vaguely, they have to do that in order to make a living, if that has changed, nobody's going to do it for you and you know, sell your records. The Virgin Records store in Times Square is closed. You know, it's
On the tower. Remember, there used to be a tower up on 66th and Broadway. That closed about more than 5 years ago.
Right. And so if you're a pop rock artist, what do you do? How do you make a living? I don't know. You do a Broadway show, I guess, or you... And that's no success. I think, you know, one thing I'd like to see about Broadway and mm-hmm. is that I'd like to see more younger playwrights, and I don't mean chronologically, get a chance to do a Broadway show. I think it's unconscionable that more playwrights can't get a shot at Broadway, and it's always been my theory that they should take a few of those theaters, the Manhattan Theater Club, and, you know, I guess roundabout there.
They're starting, especially MTC. They have a Broadway theater now, and that's helping a little bit. Everything else is either revivals or stuff from London, you know. Musicals, young people are getting a shot now, because you've got Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, and you have Avenue Q, and you've got... I mean, there's pockets there where that's starting. But, and then also, if you have a huge hit off-Broadway, if you're maybe David Auburn or, Sarah Rule... Sarah Rule got lucky. I mean, she wrote a wonderful play last year that I think should have won the Tony. So there's a little bit, but it should be not one or two per season. I mean, you know, you grew up, your father grew up when there were 300 plays on shows on Broadway.
On Broadway in the 20s. That's correct. 300 opened. And in London, you have many more shows, many more comedies and dramas open. And they run shorter periods of time, but... I think that the union costs are so tremendous on Broadway, and why should a one person or two person show? I don't know how much the show with Patrick Stewart, A Life in the Theater, costs. It's a very lovely show, nice comedy. You know, it's a revival of the David Mamet show
of
20 years ago or so. And I don't know how much that costs, but do you know how much that costs? But it shouldn't cost. The more stagehands coming out and moving the scenery
That ruined the show. I like, you know, that's a lovely play. If you get to see, I'm talking also to the listeners, the video version of that with Ellis Rabb. They did it about 25 years ago or so. And it's a lovely teleplay that they made out of Mamet's play. But it's a very difficult play to do because the scenes are very short. And suddenly the actors have to go off, change makeup, change clothes, change the scenery. It's an insane play. Mamet was young when he wrote it. He didn't really know what went into having to stage something like that. But if you get the right director, they can finesse it. And the whole point is to make it seamless and transition very quickly. On Broadway, because they wanted to throw money at it and put big vogue up there and set, suddenly, they're throwing thousands and thousands of dollars at it, and all they're doing is having these poor stagehands schlep this giant scenery on, and then a minute later schlep it off, and it killed the show.
Right. I know what you mean. I tried to ignore that, you know, and I said, although once in a while, you had to look up and say, who are these guys moving the scenery? You know, it's getting away from the story.
Yeah, there was no momentum. Every time it was building character, or you're seeing the arc of their relationship, and it's like, and then, boom, like, lights down, they have to go on, change their makeup. The show should have run 75 minutes, and it ran 90. And extra 15 kills it.
Also, On the Waterfront, you know, which I saw in London a couple of years ago, was a very scaled-down version from the one on Broadway. It wasn't really anything like it. And if you know if your listeners are familiar with the movie, it's a very intimate movie in that some of the most... glorious scenes are the ones in the back of a taxi cab when when two people are talking together. But it worked in London because it was a scaled down version and it was intimate. On Broadway, they tried to build the Brooklyn Bridge practically and the Brooklyn waterfront, and you know it was. I think they tried to do what they thought was best, but it wasn't.
I have to say I saw that Broadway on the waterfront and I liked it. I thought the story still held, even though it was done big. But I can imagine it working like gangbusters in an intimate setting. As a matter of fact, and I don't mean to to steal your thunder here, Ward Morehouse. First of all, I want to tell everybody we're talking to Ward Morehouse III, author of London's Grand Hotels, Extraordinary People, Extraordinary Service in the World's Cultural Capital, published by Bear Manor Media. Okay.
Media, and the website is pretty extensive, bearmanormedia.com. And you'll find everything from Tom Mix to Roy Rogers to, well, not just Western stars, but people like Fanny Bryce and, you know, the old-time Broadway and vaudeville people and film people.
Well, what I want to tell listeners about, especially at UNC, the University of Northern Colorado, is there's another example of what we were just talking about. They're doing at the school Blood Brothers. Now, this show, you're the London guy. You know that's been running in London since 1988. It's still running.
Yeah,
right?
Wow, yes. I know that. You hardly notice it when you go over there now, but I remember it on Broadway. It didn't do too badly, but it had a much shorter run.
It didn't happen on Broadway. The flaws were just too big, and they did it big, and some people really loved it, but the critics were eh. And it didn't catch on the way, certainly, that it has in London. Well, here, I saw the production at UNC last week, directed by John Leonard, and they do exactly what we're talking about. He scales it back. It's small. It's intimate. It's in a little theater that holds, I think, about 125 people at most. And in fact, they took away one side. It's a theater in the round, but they took away one side so they could put the orchestra on one area. So it's a three-sided theater now with even fewer seats. And there's still problems with the piece. I don't think the lyrics are very good, but it tells a very, a good story about class structure and these two brothers who are raised separately and all that. And you get into it, and it's very tense. And it's amusing, and you get into the characters, which you totally lost on Broadway. So there is something to be said for the scaling back. And I do want to, since I broke in, I want to remind people that they have three more chances to see Blood Brothers at the Norton Theater at UNC. They're playing two shows today, a matinee and an evening show, and one more show tomorrow. And sorry to break in to do this, Ward, but actually we've been talking for a while, and I haven't had a chance to do commercials and stuff. So
definitely. And you're also on extensive following on the web, don't you, your show?
Oh, well, gosh, thanks.
it's extensive. It's getting back to what you were saying earlier about the music business. We're sort of... It's one thing to get on the web. It's another thing to get listeners viewers or people that are visitors.
Well, I've been doing this for 8 years, so hopefully there's a couple of people listening here and there. But if you're listening in around Greeley, Colorado, Blood Brothers 2 today and 7:30 today, and then tomorrow afternoon at 2. Let's see. For advance tickets, call 970-351-2200. It's at the Norton Theater, which is located on the Central Campus in Gray Hall. Let's see, blah, blah, blah. Oh, and this is, this will mean nothing to you, Ward, but if you go and you fill out a thing at the theater, you can win, you get a chance to win free tickets to see Keisha, who's apparently playing locally in either Denver or Northern Colorado. She's some pop music icon person. So if you go, you leave your ticket stub and your number on it, and they give you a box to put in at the end of the show. And then on Sunday night, I believe, tomorrow night, they'll be doing a drawing on the air Sunday at 7 o'clock for the winner of the tickets to Keisha. So it's another reason to go see Blood Brothers at the Norton Theater this weekend. Okay, sorry to pull focus from you, Ward, but we're talking with Ward Morehouse.
What's the name of the bookstore in Denver, Colorado? It's like the Strand in New York City.
I don't know.
It's an independent bookstore.
Good for them. I'm glad there is one.
Yeah.
I mostly stay in and around Greeley because we don't have a car at this point, so we haven't been to Denver very much except to the airport. But if anybody knows, drop me an email, davesgoneby@aol.com. I guess I can Google it, but I'd rather talk to Ward Morehouse for a few more minutes and ask him some of the cool, funny, weird anecdotes about these people in these hotels, these London Grand Hotels?
Well, you know, one of the grandest hotels is the Savoy Hotel, which opened recently, and that's where Vivien Leigh and Laurence Olivier first set eyes on each other in the dining room. It's reopened after what some say is half a billion pound renovation. And it's a Fairmont Hotel, but it's owned partly by Prince Al Walid, who is the Saudi Arabian billionaire who at one time actually owns part of Fairmont. And but anyway, many famous stars. Elaine Stritch had lived there when she was in London. She now lives in the Carlisle. I don't think I'm telling anything out of school because she announces it at her shows. And there's high security there. But Richard Harris, who was in Camelot, the movie, and many other plays, many movies, lived at the Savoy. And he would, they'd have to corral him to pay his bills. And when he had the cash, he used to run up his bill. And when he was working, there was absolutely no problem.
Right.
But he would be 6 to 12 month periods when he didn't have any work. And so the manager would have to run him down, and not literally, but track him down and say, Mr. Harris, I'd like to talk to you about your bill. Richard Harris would say, well, let's go next door and have a Guinness.
And 15 Guinnesses later.
I'll only talk to you if you have a Guinness. And so they went next door, and the manager would say, Mr. Harris, you owe us a lot of money. When are you going to pay? And, of course, he was in Harry Potter, the movie. He made a pile of money, and he was able to pay his bills. But the only way that the manager could get through was to go next door and have a Guinness with him, have a beer with him. But Charlie Chaplin and his family lived at the Savoy, and one of the former managers or assistant managers, Derek Picot, who's manager of the Jeremiah Carlton Tower to this day, or currently, said that as a young assistant manager of the Savoy, he took Mr. Chaplin and Ona Ona O'Neill, Una, and you know, Geraldine Chaplin's mother. Maybe the children, maybe Geraldine was young. I'm not sure exactly how old she was at the time. But he took them up to took them up to their suite on the river. The Savoy's right on the Thames River, and everything was in order. They had a bottle of champagne, that kind of thing. And then Derek Picot walked into an armoire or a closet instead of walking out the front door. You know, he's so nervous. By serving Charlie Chaplin,
right,
who was an icon of the film business in America. And he walked into the closet. He stayed there for a few minutes. Then he came out. and then Chaplin was looking at him very bemusedly and said, Picot said, yeah, I was just checking. Of course, there was nothing to check. He was in a closet, you know, and it was dark. He told me later, he got in the closet, he didn't know what to do. He was hoping they would leave and go to the bedroom or just go out the hall
sneak.
Or something and go about their business somewhere else in the hall. They didn't leave. They were sitting there, and when he opened the door very gingerly and shamefacedly, there they were looking right at him, you know. He was so, like, falling through the floor, you know.
It was
one of those odd experiences at the Savoy. And, you know, I recently took a tour of it, and they had a stage that used to come up from the floor, like Radio City Music Hall, I guess, and the Rainbow Room at the Rockefeller Center, you know, that kind of thing. But I think that the hydraulic system has been taken out, and it's now part of a bar, a new bar that's been installed in the Savoy. You know, a lot of people used to go to the Savoy, Churchill and Noel Coward and many Cole Porter. Many people stayed there. Many people went to the American Bar at the Savoy, which looks exactly like it did, say, in the 1920s or 30s. Very stark, very white, full of... it doesn't have a lot of charm, but it's where American theatrical people sort of flocked, and some of the more famous British theater people like Noel Coward. And there's a Noel Coward suite, which I took a tour of in the Savoy. Of course, Noel Coward didn't... never stayed there, at least as far as they know. but he may have visited friends there, but he never actually, they just named the suite after him and sort of gave it a very Art Deco look. And, you know, it's kind of a fun idea that Meryl Streep and, you know, other people. I've got a number of stories of celebrities who, when I was in London, I was working for Reuters, and I was interviewing Richard Branson, and so he got so tired of me following him around that we went to school to pick up one of his kids, and he said, "Will you pay my parking meter?" Well, I'm in getting the kid, you know?
Yeah.
And and he's this billionaire, you know, I'm paying his parking meter for him. But
well, billionaires don't necessarily have a dollar in their pocket while they're you know, that's the old joke.
Yeah, and that's the old story, like Jack Kennedy, right? My favorite story about Jack Kennedy at the Plaza was that, and my book is Inside the Plaza or InsideThePlaza.com, and Kennedy and I guess Jackie were there at the Persian Room, and Hildegard, who was the famous Jean Tu, Montevecchi, or you know some of the people around today who do cabaret, but anyway. It was more of a nightclub setting, a big nightclub setting. Tony Bennett used to do the Empire Room of the Waldorf years ago. And anyway, so she slipped and fell when Kennedy was at ringside in the Persian Room. And she got up with some assistance, and she said, "You see, he was a senator. This is Senator John F. Kennedy. And said, "You see, Senator, I've fallen for you."
Aww.
So she made a graceful exit, you know, and but she was a great character, and some of these people are great characters. George M. Cohan was a great devotee of London hotels and lived at the Savoy Plaza in New York, and of course wrote all those songs that won him a Congressional Medal of Honor, something like that, and from Roosevelt, and he was he traveled to London on what they call the fast boats, and then they would go to the Savoy or the Ritz or that kind of thing, and you know it's a place. The thing that's fascinating about hotels is you can go there and you don't have to spend a lot of money on a big suite there. You can go and just have a drink at the Rivoli Bar at the Ritz or at the American Bar at the Savoy, or have a cup of tea. You don't have to have all those muffins and everything, and just enjoy the atmosphere. And they're public places, and you and I can,
We're as entitled to sit in one of these bars or these little places in these hotels in the lobby, and enjoy it as much as somebody staying there. Somebody paying $500 a night per suite, you can go in there and get, you know, a beer for $5-6 and soak in the atmosphere for an hour. I mean, which is kind of nice.
That's exactly right. And some of them, believe it or not, have special deals where you can get, complimentary breakfast for two. You can get the bottle of champagne, and they're located in areas that are much more convenient. So you can, if you can't save money, they're not as expensive in the long run as you might think. I mean, I don't know what the Waldorf is today, and maybe some people complain about the long lines of the Waldorf, the check-in places. But at one time, I think during the worst of the downturn in the economy of last year, you could get a room for $180, which
it's
pretty good comparatively.
Yeah.
The location is good. 50th and Park Avenue, 50th and Lexington Avenue. You can walk over to the theater and that kind of thing. In New York, the Edison Hotel is I've never stayed there, but it's where the so-called Polish Tea Room is. And
everybody's eaten in the Polish Tea Room. We've all done that. It's what is the Edison Cafe, the Edison diner?
Let me ask you, Ward, about Neil Simon did a play of 45 Seconds from Broadway set in the Edison Cafe.
Yeah. Well, the cafe is better than that play was.
It only lasted 45 seconds on Broadway. If I was writing for the Post, I'd say, you know, it shouldn't have lasted 45 seconds. No, imagine.
It was pretty bad, yeah. But let me ask you, Ward, literally in the news this week, it just occurred to me that they're trying to sell the Chelsea Hotel in New York. Yeah. It's not, I'm not a glamorous place by any stretch, but what are your thoughts on that and the stories that come out of there?
Well, it's got to be the most illustrious, one of the most illustrious hotels of them all as far as artists and writers and musicians. Sid Vicious was found dead there, whether, I guess he was murdered, I'm not sure of what happened, but Thomas Wolfe lived there, Brendan Behan lived there, many authors and writers and musicians, both pop rock and classical, lived there over the years. Pete Hamill lived there after he was getting a divorce for a year or so, he told me. It's a great place. It's tourists. Some tourists, unless they're have a bohemian streak, might not like some of the rooms because they haven't been updated. I would hate to see it become a boutique hotel with all the finest gold faucets and amenities and beautiful cabinetry in the rooms. Now, some people are on what they call permit leases. They have long-term leases. I don't know what they could do with those people. Maybe they're on rent control. Yeah. But I think it would be a shame to turn it into, something that it's not. You know, you can do that with a lot of buildings. There's a beautiful hotel called the Crosby Street Hotel, which is new construction down near the Public Theater, and that's beautifully designed and it's a first class, it has sister hotels or brother hotels in London, the Haymarket Hotel, the Covent Garden Hotel. They're exquisite gems of places.
But that's a brand new hotel that they construct from.
Right.
They're not
a brand
taking
new hotel. They construct it. But I would hate to see the Chelsea turned in, no matter who buys it, whether it's a wealthy individuals or a chain, turn it into some kind of cookie cutter place. It would be like the Algonquin, which has very small rooms, and I think it's owned by the Marriott people now. It changes hands so quickly, so frequently, rather. But it's run, I think the reservation system at least is Marriott, and maybe that's good for them. But, you'd hate to see it, that lobby torn out and put a modern lobby in. Yeah. Or the rooms, I think, leave a little to be desired because they probably haven't been updated. But I don't know if they have or not. But
if you update them, keep the old feel, that kind of thing.
That's exactly right, because there are plenty of new hotels in New York or in London. Some people in London don't like what happened to the Mandarin Oriental Hotel. That was a Victorian hotel right on Hyde Park. And, the exterior is the same as it ever was, but inside it's very modern. Brown's Hotel, which I mentioned, that was started originally by a lady-in-waiting to Lord Byron's wife, was back in the early 1800s, was just this one little townhouse. Brown's Hotel is very modern on the inside. Some people don't like it. But, that's, I think younger people like that trendy quality that the modern schemes have. I must say that I'm the old style better.
Let me ask you, Ward.
We
only have a couple minutes left to talk here. Now, one thing I'm curious about, like when we're searching this book or the other books, in case someone like me wanted to do what you're doing, I'm curious, is it sort of, when you're a theater critic, one of the perks is, because you don't really get paid a lot, is that you get to go to the theater for free, and, the trade-off is that you have to write about it and all that and study
the
show.
Right, that's correct.
In traveling, how much...
There's no free lunch, even in the theater. You might go for free, but you still have to produce a review or commentary or something, website. But I think that, one of the perks is you do get complimentary rooms. I've never...
Oh, wow.
In all the writing, I mean, not all the time, but in some cases, but in all the writing, I've never asked for a complimentary room or what they call a free room. There's no such thing as a free room because you're doing something for it, whether you're writing about it, whether you're a vendor, whether you're... whatever you're doing.
But when you go to visit, one of the hotels in your books, it's do you go to the front desk and say, by the way, I'm here to write, or how does that work out, that they know that you're there to do what you're doing?
Well, I think that you have to really talk probably to the PR people and just say that I'm going to do a story for you know, Travel and Leisure or whatever. A lot of the magazines these days are and the newsletters, and that has changed too much. So finding a travel writer who's actually on the staff is like finding, a hen's tooth in a payloft or something. It's just you call the Times travel desk and you've got two people there. So I think on the staff, maybe it's more, of course, but you know, it's changed dramatically. A lot of travel writers are freelancers. They call the PR people for the hotel, and they have a track record of doing either travel stories or entertainment stories. You can see their stuff on the web. I'm sure they can see yours. They can see mine.
So you plan beforehand.
They have a generous policy. They'll accommodate you if you're legitimately doing a story or a book or something like that. They tend to. In some cases, I've been charged like $150 for a room, and I paid it. And in other cases, it's been complimentary. So it's a, but I couldn't afford to do it otherwise. And I think the travel writers, the old policy of the New York Times was that they couldn't accept. I don't know what they're doing with freelancers, but the New York Times and the Christian Science Monitor, some of those older established papers, wouldn't accept. What they call junkets for travel writers, and it had to be offered to the paper, and then the paper could offer it to a freelancer, I guess, is the way it goes. But I don't know. I think if you're doing a legitimate story, it's just like getting tickets for a bet,
right,
or the life of the theater, some of the Broadway shows. The press agents are pretty savvy. They'll accommodate you,
because they know within a week or two or three or whenever you'll be writing something that is posted that people will see.
That's right. I do. I also do, David, a column for a travel newsletter called TravelSmartNewsletter.com. It goes to quite a few thousands of people.
Ah.
It's on the web. TravelSmartNewsletter.com, and it's also sent out as a hard copy. So I do what they call the checking in column, and I've done that for about 4 years. And I go to a hotel. This summer I went to Cooperstown, New York, and did a big three page spread on Cooperstown and where you could stay. There are several old Victorian hotels that have bed and breakfast. So I stayed in one and I talked to people who ran other ones, and so it was a nice. Cooperstown is known for being the Baseball Hall of Fame, but it's a lot more. James Fenimore Cooper lived there and wrote set some of his novels
in
that area.
Is that why they call it Cooperstown, or is that just a coincidence?
No. It's named after his father, who was a judge, Judge Cooper, who was a New York state judge in that, I believe, in that area, who settled there. And James Fenimore Cooper, the son, wrote about Cooperstown and Lake Glimmerglass, which is there's another name I can't recall at the moment, but he called it Lake Glimmerglass. So when you read the Leatherstocking Tales, it's actually he calls it Lake Glimmerglass, but it's another name as well. That area is protected largely from a lot of the tract of home building that is on Lake George and some of the other lakes in New York State. So that's a good thing in for Cooperstown. But it's so close to New York. It's an hour. No, it's about 3 hours away. But it's a nice. And you don't have to be a dyed-in-the-wool baseball fan either. Although many people go for that reason. I'll go to an occasional game, but I can't call myself a fan really.
I went to Canton, Ohio, about a year and a half ago for other reasons. Really, the only reason to go to Canton, Ohio is the Football Hall of Fame. Really not that much else out there. Even Akron.
Right.
Sorry, Ohioans, but. But still. But anyway, we kind of have to wrap this up.
Well, I want the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, although there's the Cleveland Playhouse, too. I wanted to do a story on Cleveland, and I've actually talked to the Cleveland. Also, another thing is the people that are helpful, the various tourist bureaus are very helpful and accommodating. So, I think it's a question of, they're interested in publicity, and I try to be fairly honest about writing about these places, and I'm honest about the price too. I mean, I couldn't afford to stay. I was paying full price in some of these hotels, the Cole Porter Suite or the Frank Sinatra Suite at the Waldorf was $147,000 a month now.
Good Lord,
that's a lot of money. Yeah,
and it amazes me some people can pay it. That's the more amazing thing. It doesn't just sit there empty. That there's some rich person who will pay that. Amazing.
That's exactly right. And then I think that we little, and it's very often they're not Americans. They're from foreign countries. In the case of that particular suite, the Capitol Records pitched in on the, I don't know exactly the breakdown, but then when Frank Sinatra lived there for a number of years, there was some money that they paid. Cole Porter paid considerably less because he got it in the depths of the recession. I mean, the depression in 1932, and they were practically giving away the rooms. Elsa Maxwell, who was a columnist, lived there, and she, various reports say she lived there rent free. She worked for it. She organized parties at the Waldorf. She did a column that always mentioned the Waldorf. And that's another thing that's changed about hotels. You're not supposed to write, if you can, help it, write about stars or public names that are staying in the hotels unless they're at a public event. For instance, Liz Taylor and Richard Burton used to stay at the Dorchester and do movie premiere junkets there and talk to reporters in the public spaces, so you could write about that. But you really were prohibited, or it wasn't advised to write about,
if someone just happened to be staying
on
there
on their own.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's a privacy issue, and kind of makes sense. Although it is good, and it's good publicity for the hotel. Maybe after they've left.
Right, Michael Jackson actually stays at, I didn't put this in the book, the Lanesboro is right across from the Duke of Wellington's ancestral home at number one London. That's the Duke of Wellington's home, but the Lanesboro is on the site of the old palace, the Duke of Lanesboro, and right at Hyde Park Corner. And Michael Jackson actually stayed there on some of his visits to London. I didn't write about that because I think he was still alive and I was still doing research about it. Mm. And, it's an unwritten rule that you don't write about anybody that's really, for security reasons. Years ago, the hotel PR people used to put out press releases with the guests that were coming in with their, not only their addresses, but their home phone numbers.
Yeah.
It was a different world. It was in the 1950s I came across old press releases with society figures' phone numbers, addresses and personal phone numbers. And it was a, now it's a different world. Everybody's security conscious or worried about, terrorism or worried about their personal safety. And I guess for good reason. I think that sometimes we're a little too obsessed with it. But, it's a different world than it was, 4 years ago when we didn't have as many threats to people's safety. It didn't seem, anyway. Of course, London underwent the London Blitz, and some of the hotels were bombed.
Wow.
And so it was not a 30,000 people died. I mean, it wasn't a. It was a terrible thing, and many, many more were wounded. So it was an awful thing. But they lived through it. And one place that people liked to stay in London during the Blitz was the Dorchester, because it was reinforced concrete. It was one of the only hotels that at that time, the other hotels were stone and steel, but this was reinforced concrete, so when it was hit, I didn't have a direct hit, I don't believe. It was a bombing from the German Air Force.
But China got rattled a little bit, but the rest of the building stayed okay.
Yeah, right, exactly, right. Yeah, and Pamela Harriman first met Avril Harriman during the war, and then they later married about 30 years later. so at the Dorchester, and it's a very fine hotel. It's owned by the Sultan of Brunei right now, and I think some of the stars gravitate toward the smaller places, the more boutique hotels, because there's more privacy. When the Rolling Stones are in London, I'm not exactly sure where they stay, but they don't stay at the big glitzy hotels. They stay at the smaller boutique hotels. Maybe they have their own homes there. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
anyway, we have to wrap this up, Mort. But this has been really, really a lot of fun and great talking about the theater and travel and hotels in New York and London. And certainly if people want to read London's Grand Hotels, Ward's new book, they can go to the website of the publisher, as you said, BearManorMedia.com.
Well,
and you have
LondonsGrandHotels.com, too.
Oh, LondonsGrandHotels.com. And also to check out
a little bit more about the book.
To check out Ward's writing, you can also go to BroadwayAfterDark.com. And not only Ward's writing, but that's the site that he edits with all sorts of reviews and stories about New York and Broadway, and probably some travel, too, at this point. So, Ward, last question. What are you... I know you're updating your book on the Plaza. What are you... What's your next project that you're tackling?
I don't know. There's several possibilities, but I really... At this point, I'm doing a little bit of promotion. I thank you very much for being on your show. And, I think the Broadway community misses you because I think you were a fixture there yourself, but you must... it must be a nice... it's a little...
Colorado's nice. Colorado has its charm, it really does.
Oh yes, I bet it does. But yeah, compared to 42nd Street and Broadway these days, with it's a kind of a madhouse. But I'm not sure yet. But I'm toying with the idea of another hotel book, and there's always another city. I've actually done a. Some hotels in San Francisco, like the Fairmont and others. I've done some in Los Angeles, for magazine articles. But I don't know. I haven't been out there recently, and also I think you really have to spend some time there to do some research. And I think sitting by the pool at the Beverly Hotel would be a hardship at this point for me. Don't you? I mean, that's. I'm joking. Oh, yeah. Oddly enough, you can go there. I think I never stayed in the Beverly Hills. I stayed a couple other hotels, but you can go there if you have lunch there. You can use the pool. So that's a tip for your listeners. Nobody uses the pool there because they all have their own pools.
Oh,
so you have lunch, you have a turkey sandwich, and then you. And you use the pool.
But even in the finest hotels, you still have to wait a half hour after you eat. Still, like, it doesn't matter how fancy the pool is. You still need to wait a half hour.
Right.
Well, Ward Morehouse, thank you very, very much. Best of luck with your travels and your writing and your website. And thank you really for having a delightful chat with us here. In our special neighborhood on Dave's Gone By. Thanks so much, man.
Thanks, Dave. Okay. Bye-bye.